Welcome to episode 24 of Extra Sequential, your weekly dose of manga, comic books, and graphic novels, hosted out of Perth, Australia by me, Mladen Lukatin.
And me, Chris Bader, who's just recognised that Pepsi have changed their logo. I'm just drinking a Pepsi Cola bottle and it looks like they've gone retro. I don't know if this is just for this label or if they've just changed their...
Did you only just notice?
...logo permanently. Yeah, well, I don't drink soft drinks that often.
Yeah.
Because I'm such a health nut, as you know.
Did they change it back? Ah, okay.
It looks like it's from the 60s.
Oh, because they went to like this weird one that looks like a football logo, and then they've...
Okay.
Well, that's what it looks like to me. It looks like a sporting commission or something. Very exciting. Okay. But we're not here to talk about Pepsi or corporate branding, although maybe later. I may have something that ties into that, actually.
Wow.
We're here to talk about comic books and graphic novels, and specifically this week we're going to be talking about anthropomorphic comics, and that is
yes,
animals with human thoughts and bodies.
See, I was defining this, or attempted to define this, with a colleague at work this very morn, and we were kind of saying it's not just animals necessarily.
Okay.
Like, you know, if a broomstick is dancing, does that mean it's anthropomorphic because it's got human characteristics on a non-human object, even if it doesn't talk?
I get you. I think that's I'm just looking up anthropomorphism. We should have done this before the show, but
should have.
I think
if an alien talks, like Mr.
Yeah.
Spock,
he's not an inanimate object that we've applied human characteristics to, unless if the idea is
it's not an animal.
Yeah, but we have applied human characteristics to the concept of an alien thing. But then, you know, you could say anything is... Ah, doesn't matter. So, whatever. Because, yeah, you're right. I had considered, say, bone. But then I thought, wait, they're not really animals. They're bones.
But, yeah, I thought about, like, the Muppets and...
Yeah. Well, Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy count. But I wanted to keep within the realm of comics more so than TV shows. But
yes,
that's what we'll be digging into later on in the show. And we found a few different categories. And
Yeah,
deeper than I thought anyway. Surprise, surprise.
We're full of surprises. Shall we get to the news?
Will there be surprising news?
Yes, you'll be surprised.
Okay.
Not really.
All right, I'll put my drink down. Go.
News for the weekend of the 23rd of January 2011. The blogosphere, internetosphere, has been alight this week as both Spider-Man and Captain America pics have been released online from those films.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a couple of set photos of the Spider-Man film that's not due out for another year and a half, but Sony Columbia just released the first official pic last week of Andrew Garfield from The Social Network as Spider-Man with his mask off, and you can just see him from the waist up. He's got some cuts on him and stuff, so you just get a first look at the costume. And he's got web shooters, which is good because I never liked the organic web shooters from the Tobey Maguire, Sam Raimi film.
Such a purist, Chris.
I am, very much so. And Captain America pics also official have been released in the Entertainment Weekly magazine, where we can see Chris Evans in his full World War II. So it's not a skin-tight outfit like the comics was, but it's more like the ultimate version that Marvel have had in their comics over the last 5 years. So it's the guy now, the wings, but he's still got the A on his helmet, but he looks a lot more like an actual soldier,
mm-hmm.
which is what they're going for. You've seen both pictures.
I have, and the release of the Spider-Man ones straight after the Captain American ones were a genius piece of marketing.
Yeah, it's both on the same day.
Yeah, the Captain America ones came out first, and then they kind of, I think they were holding this picture in just in case to steal the thunder from the Captain America thing, because Spider-Man is going to be bigger news.
And they are rival studios. Even I mean, Captain America is a Marvel film. Spider-Man is not. So, yeah, you could be right.
Who is Spider-Man? Is that with Universal or Warner Brothers?
Sony.
Sony.
Warner Brothers owns DC. So, yeah, because Sony bought up the rights to Spider-Man, and X-Men are owned by Fox.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Fox Searchlight and all that.
So this was before Marvel had its own film studio. So Iron Man was the first Marvel film. And now Captain America, Thor, and the Avengers, etc., and Hulk will all be...
Well, I guess we should give our thoughts on the actual pictures themselves, and I guess it's not much to talk about just yet for the Spider-Man one. I mean, I like Andrew Garfield as an actor. I liked him in that Terry Gilliam Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Oh, yes,
He was quite good in that.
Yes.
And, of course, I liked him in Social Network. But
yes.
I probably still
like the new Spider-Man costume. It's different. I never liked the silver webbing, and I talk about this in my blog, but I never liked the silver webbing. The suits cost like $100,000, so I mean, this one looks like Peter Parker could almost make it himself. It's more skin tight. He looks skinnier.
Yeah, that's his build,
Yeah, and it has to be tweaked because it doesn't want to look like, oh, look, Spider-Man 4. That doesn't look like Tobey Maguire. It has to separate itself from what's gone before, and it has to separate itself from the disastrous Broadway musical. And I think this costume does that. It still looks like Spider-Man, but a bit sleeker. So, I'm reasonably excited to see this film. And apparently J. Jonah Jameson isn't in it for some reason.
Oh, fair enough.
But he's still in high school, so perhaps in the second film he'll, get a job at the Daily Bugle.
So they can market it kind of as a semi-prequel. So then people get confused when you say reboot, especially when the last film came out, 2-3 years ago?
Yeah, 2007. So when this Spider-Man comes out, 2012, that's only 5 years after a complete reboot. And, I mean, Spider-Man 2 and 3, that will still be showing on TV for a while yet. So, yeah, you're right, it'll still be... People are going, where's Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst?
It's a brand, so they don't want to confuse people too much, I think. People like what they know. But I don't think I'll see this still. You can tell me if it's good. If it blows your mind, maybe I will.
I'll tell you in a year and a half. Do you think we'll still be doing this podcast by then?
Don't jinx it. Also, Captain America, what do you think?
Yes, Captain America comes out mid-year, as does X-Men First Class. I liked it. It does, we haven't seen pictures of Hugo Weaving as Red Skull just as yet, but we've seen concept art and Halloween costumes.
Yeah, I was going to say the official Halloween outfits are out, and that gives it away, doesn't it? I like Hugo.
But, I like it. I mean, I think Chris Evans is a good prick. He's certainly bulky enough, and... Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I said, the costume looks like a soldier's costume in World War II.
Yeah.
So I'm glad they took that route. Otherwise, Captain America would have really stood out, and he's got the shield and everything. So it doesn't look goofy. It blends in well.
Yeah. I'm no expert on Captain America, but another film which is going the retro route is the X-Men prequel thing, and the shots have been released for that as well.
Yeah, the X-Men, the first official promo shot of the assembled actors.
Yeah.
So because Michael Fassbender is a young Magneto, James McAvoy is a young Professor X, Rose Byrne is in there. And they've been released yesterday, but there seems to be a bit of back and forth and confusion if it's actually an official photo or not.
Yeah.
Some people have taken it down, and there's been updates even in the last few minutes I've been looking. So, it looks like that could be the proper costumes.
The costumes look good, but it's pretty uninspiring photo. Yeah.
It is. It's very Photoshop 101. It's set in the 60s, X-Men First Class. So
I suspect they'll skimp on the period setting. You know, like Wolverine Origins, that apparently was set in the 70s.
But you couldn't tell.
Yeah, so I'm sort of suspecting the same thing here, which would be a huge shame to not capitalize on kind of 60s.
Yeah, I want to see bell bottoms, man, and hippies.
Well, I want to see some wild. Like, I think X-Men, and because I watched The Prisoner recently, everything about The Prisoner reeks like of early X-Men, and I'm just hoping they add that vibe. Very colourful retro stylings, bizarre. I hope they go for period music rather than the typical movie score that you hear every day these days. Yes. Today I watched, I'll just mention, it's not really news, but it's kind of flown under the radar a bit, probably because the movie will be terrible. But there's a movie called Priest, which is coming out.
Yes, I was going to mention that to you. Yes.
Based on the manga.
Are you not familiar with the manga?
Only, I know what it looks like, I've never read it. So, yeah. But what's his face in it? I can't remember the guy's
name.
Paul Bettany, who played a monk or priest in The Da Vinci Code as well.
And he was also in the the Angel film.
Yeah, another similar thing. So he's
my God, I think this guy. He's married to Jennifer Connelly, so I think you'd understand that he's blessed. But anyway,
ha ha ha. Anyway, he's starring in a lot of terrible movies, and this looks like it's joining them. So that's a manga.
But it does have Maggie Q in it, so I'll watch it.
Yeah. So I've got to remember to think of that one when we think of comic book movies of 2011. There are a few. My interest in Thor is very low. How are you going with it? Do you want to see it?
I do want to see it. I like the trailer that they released. It's interesting. Natalie Portman's in it, so she's got she won the Golden Globes, didn't she, for Black Swan. So I guess that'll help propel it into the spotlight even more. But Anthony Hopkins and
How great were the Golden Globes, by the way? Did you watch all of Ricky Gervais's?
I did not. I just heard him at the end doing his usual God-bashing stuff.
He didn't bash God.
Oh, he did very much so, my lad.
No, he didn't. He said, thank you, God, for making me an atheist. Yeah, if you think that's God bashing, Chris, you're very sensitive. Come on.
I know Ricky, I don't know him personally, but I know that he is a very proud atheist. And a lot of English stand-up comedians seem to be. I don't get it. Anyway, that's not a time or place for such discussions. But
I think that'll be a point where we disagree with each other and we'll have to leave it at that. Hey, we're a comics podcast.
No, I didn't watch the Golden Globes.
Hey, do we have any other news pieces?
In Perth, we have the WACON, which is the, I don't know what it stands for, West Australian convention. But if you go to WACON, WAICON.org, I believe it is, January 29 and 30, which is next weekend, you'll be able to go to the Perth Convention Centre here in Perth, Western Australia, for basically, the next annual anime manga type convention. There'll be cosplays, there's panels and vendors. Spike Spencer, I think his name is apparently quite a well-known. He does the Japanese dubbing of like Evangelion and a few other shows. He's going to be there both days talking at a panel. So if you want to go, that's the weekend, the 29th and 30th of January in Perth, if you're around and you like anime and manga.
Very cool. Have you ever been yourself?
I have not. Yeah. And it's going to be in the midst of summer and, stuff. If it was, I'd always go to the, as you know, I didn't go last year, but the Supernova Convention, which is the comic book equivalent here in Perth.
Right.
And we've been to that, I believe, so I'll go to that mid-year.
Yeah. As much as I love manga and anime, and I do, don't care for manga and anime fans. So I think I'll be skipping WACON this year.
Your nose is pointing to the ceiling right now.
No, I've been a couple of times, and the vibe's very odd. You notice the same thing. You might have noticed the same things with some comic book cons, maybe less so with recent ones because they're more like cross media and all that. But it's a bit of a pissing contest.
Like, how so?
Nerds,
my costume's better than yours.
Yeah, that, and nerds tend to be very snobby about knowing more than each other.
Yeah, some are, usually the teenagers.
Yeah, and a lot of teenagers go to WACON, so maybe when it grows up a bit.
Okay.
Burn.
You'll be such a good father.
I know, right? Oh, I'm not letting my teenagers be into anything that I don't approve of.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just going to drive them further away, man, and they'll be bringing back tattooed bikers before you can blink.
I don't see the connection.
That's enough for the news?
I think so. This week, I had the pleasure of dipping into two fairly new titles for once.
I think we both shocked each other today, as in our segment, what we've been reading.
Yeah. Well, I can't remember what you picked, but I remember being fairly surprised. Oh, yeah. Okay, no, I think I remember. I picked up softcover collection of Viking, which is a series from Image by Ivan Brandon, and Nick Klein is the artist. And I think they've put out like a six-issue mini. Anyway, I guess it was brought on by, it would have been in pre-production about the same time as Brian Wood's Northlanders, but I guess it is at the right time. People are interested in Viking comics again, which I'm always happy about because I like anything historic-y. I like swords of fun, especially if they're well illustrated. And this is very
cloths.
Sure. I think it's too cold for Vikings to wear loincloths, isn't it? It's meant to be really cold up in the Norlands.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, maybe on their casual days off when they're not pillaging.
Maybe Australian Vikings in thongs and loincloths. But this has been quite interesting. It's about a pair of brothers who sort of dabble in the old Vikingry, and then they accidentally take things too far, and their younger brother's killed, and their granddad sort of disowns them. And then they try to kidnap a princess for ransom, and things go wrong, as they do, you know, in heist stories. It is framed a bit like a heist story starring Vikings. But I think the real star of this, like, the dialogue's pretty good, you know, even Brandon's work, but the real star is Nick Klein's work.
Agreed.
And, I don't know what else he's done. This is the first time I've read any of his work, I believe. I don't know if you've seen his...
I don't know, actually. I do have the first issue as a Viking, and I was going to ask you, is it in the large format? Because the original issues were bigger, so the trade paperback's bigger as well.
The trade's a nice big size, yeah. Cool. I was going to ask if the issues were smaller, but no, this is good. They've carried that on. Awesome. And I guess through in between each pages, it feels like almost like he's showing off a portfolio for future books, which is why it feels like a very strong first effort. Because from every page to page, he'll swing wildly from like pencil and inks with digital coloring to painted watercolors to like a very graphic design look, like Nightly News, Jonathan Hickman's work, to like. Putting printing effects to get like dappling, or he goes and there's like Bill Sienkiewicz kind of pages. He just kind of shows off everything he can do within his pages, and you think it would be jarring, but once you settle into the rhythm of it, it's you just sort of feel it after a while. You're like, okay, this is the kind of story it's going to be. It's a bit wild, bit rough. He's going to wildly swing between styles while he's just working out what he wants to do. And it's the better for it, because for every, like, there might be a page not my favorite kind style of art, and the next one's really painterly and lovely. So if you're into, and the color scheme's quite good as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's very earthy and it sells the kind of historicalness of it.
For sure. I've noticed a lot of indie publishers these days, they really try to push the coloring. I mean, this is Image, so they're not really an indie publisher anymore, but they still have that sort of vibe, an approach of, I guess, I'm thinking of another one. It might be Boom Studios I'm thinking of, but...
Radical?
Radical is probably the one. Yeah, Radical do lots of painterly work, don't they?
Yes, they do.
And that's a similar thing here. Like, you don't really see this kind of thing with DC and Vertigo and Marvel at all. They tend to stick to the inks and colours and pencil because they have their system, whereas, you know, I guess if it's a creator-owned book with a writer and artist, they can do what they want. I'll mention the other one, which is also another creator-owned work that I've been reading. Casanova.
I've picked up the first issue, because I think Matt Fraction, doing Iron Man, and he's now doing a new Thor series. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the book that got him on the map, as they say, and I think that it was originally black and white, but now Image are doing it, Marvel are doing it now as into the creator and imprint with colours.
That's correct.
I couldn't really get into it, but what do you think?
Well, I picked up this new soft cover collecting the icon is Marvel icon, isn't
it? Okay, that's the Marvel one.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so it's
in the colour, and it's been at the end. There's like an interview with the colourist and like the process they went through, and they limited her palette to about 45 colours, which they selected with her, and they didn't want any gradients. They wanted flat colours. I think if you're going to colour a book, it's the right way to approach it, and they've definitely gone for... The original book was black, white, and like a greeny grey.
Yes, true.
And they've still kept that sense of palette, but with adding like really wild purples and reds, and it really pops. There's samples of the black and white work, and I guess I don't miss it, so it looks quite good. My first thought while reading it was it's very... made me think of The Prisoner. I mean, anything from the 60s, which is bizarre and crazy, will always remind me of The Prisoner, because everything after that kind of pays homage to it. It's about a spy character who's part of an organization run by his dad, and he's kidnapped from his dimension and put into another dimension to take over that dimension's version of himself so he can work for the bad guys in that world.
Okay.
So he becomes a double agent, and his sister of that world isn't, you know, she's not technically his sister, and all, and there's these like the weird questions that are raised. Is this his real family? He doesn't think so. He looks a bit like Mick Jagger. It plays a bit like Next Wave, if you remember that one.
Yes, yeah, that's awesome.
That was my first thought, and with Gabriel Barr's art. He worked on Umbrella Academy, or am I mixing him up?
He did. No, you're right.
Yeah.
And I think, Gabriel Barr and Fabio Moon are twin Brazilian brothers. Mm. And I think
Names.
Moon did the second volume of what you're talking about?
Casanova. Yeah, he does a little guest story right at the end, like a little spin-off here, again, coloured. And their styles are quite different. I can't remember his brother's name. Fabio Moon, is that it?
Yep, Gabriel Barr, Fabio Moon. Yep.
Yes, great. Fabio Moon's style is a bit more, I guess, I'll say Paul Popish. And Gabriel Barr's is a bit more Mike Mignola-ish, I suppose.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
Mm. And with less heavy blacks, nice sharp edges, really kind of abstract approach to characters and so forth. It's interesting. It sort of finds its feet across the comic. That he has an interesting way of telling characters' inner thoughts. Like he'll just have a panel of the character's head and then like the text box. It works pretty well. And for the narrator, he'll put a little picture of God. So it's like God's thought bubble of like, oh, this happened in this issue. Sort of, yeah. But it's pretty wild. Crazy stuff happens. There's no point going into particulars. My favorite character is probably like this floating Krang-like. Remember from the Ninja Turtles?
Yes.
Three-headed floating Tibetan monk who's also a robot and then gets its mind replaced with the teenage girls. It's pretty good. So you tried it before, but you couldn't get into it, though?
Yeah, I just read one issue.
Mm-hmm. Overall, I'd say the first issue is a pretty good indicator, but of what it's like. But it took me a couple of issues to get into the groove of what it was trying to do. It's a fun comic, you know, a pretty light, pretty wild. Reminds you a bit of Grant Morrison's writing, to be honest.
Yeah,
in terms of characterization, and also Grant Morrison's penchant for introducing a wild, crazy story element, and then that happens to characters, you know, some dimensional rift, and then no one ever mentions it again.
Yeah.
they take it in their stride because they're so used to it, and that's a very Grant Morrison-y thing. Yeah, but that's Casanova from Matt Fraction and Gabriel Barr. Luxury is the recent reprint, so if you've been waiting for colour, here it is.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading something as equally as trippy, also from Image, like Viking, and this is called The Infinite Vacation. It's been getting a fair bit of buzz on the internet, as has a lot of Image series these days. It's written by Nick Spencer.
Yep.
He's also doing the series called Morning Glories, which is about a bunch of kids who all share the same birthday in a kind of glitzy prep school kind of thing, private school. Art is by Christian Ward, who also did another Image series called Olympus last year or the year before. Basically, it's all about you've got an iPhone application and you can buy and sell alternate versions or alternate lives of yourself.
So you
can buy like a life where you know, you stopped at that red light in time or you managed to talk to that girl and you basically just see, it's like a bit of a lucky dip, I guess, to see where it happens. Hmm. And if you get fed up with that, then you just keep moving on. So it centers on this red-headed guy, Mark, and basically he's tried them all. You know, he's done the alternate life thing to death and he still always ends up the same place. You know, he's not in love. He's got a failed relationship. He's bored. He's got a dead-end job and he just wants more and more. So he's almost like an infinite vacation junkie, I guess you could say.
Hmm.
And it's a pretty good idea. It's a very sci-fi idea that's been around for a long time, and comic books love the idea of alternate universes, especially Marvel and DC. So basically, Mark, you know, our version of Mark, as I said, he gets more and more kind of, I guess, dismayed. And then he finds out that the other versions of him are dying, and apparently some version of him is killing them all. So he's kind of swept up on...
It's like that Jet Li movie.
Oh, yeah, the one.
Yeah.
And it ends with him on top of a pyramid fighting people or something.
You are my bitch. I am not your bitch. That one, yeah. If the whole film had been that pyramid thing, that would have been the best film I've ever seen in my life. It was like a prison planet with pyramids and craziness. Does this comic have that sort of thing?
This is a lot more grounded and... That was a more so bad as good kind of. Whereas this is actually pretty good. I mean, Mark, as I said, is not a great character, and especially because there's so many different versions of him, they may struggle to make him the focus, if you know what I mean, in the coming issues.
Is he bland or is he?
No, he's just not. We don't know a lot about him. We just know that he's one of the 97% of the population that have this application, and it doesn't really discuss the science, like how does it actually work. We don't really see him walking through portals or anything like that. So the art is quite trippy. If you Google Infinite Vacation, you'll see a lot of preview art. Christian Ward is a fantastic artist, and it's very colourful, very bold. There's an interesting six-page, like I think it's called Fumetti style, where they use photos, and there's like a cheesy salesman selling the Infinite Vacation application.
Oh, okay.
So that's a bit of exposition. It's not really needed because the art is so awesome anyway. But yeah, it was pretty good. It's very designy, much in the way like Jonathan Hickman, again, with Nightwing Muse was.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't necessarily a typical comic. This is a square panel. This is a thought. There's a lot of design elements.
This looks like Red Mass for Mars. That's my first Thor.
Yes, yeah. Jonathan Hickman didn't do the art for that, I don't believe. But
is it the same dude?
No.
Ah, okay.
But, yeah, similar kind of design style. Yeah. Like, it's a comic book done by a designer rather than a comic book artist. So, that's pretty good. So that's Infinite Vacation. That's out now, but it's all sold out. So good luck trying to get a hold of a copy. But they are doing a reprint, I believe, which comes out the same day as Infinite Vacation. Number two, the last thing that I have been reading is the thing that shocked you, is a actual novel.
I can't believe it.
The only pictures are on the cover.
Yeah, but when you told me what novel it was, I was like, oh, okay.
Well, there's a bit of story. I was cleaning, because I'm basically cleaning up my room, and I've got so many comics and books and stuff that I no longer read or haven't even read, so I thought I'd take them all down to the secondhand bookstore and get some credit and see what else other goodies I could find.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got this whole stack, and this is one. This is called Star Trek New Frontier, Book 1, House of Cards. It's from 1997. It's written by Peter David, who is known as a very prolific man.
Yeah.
He's did like a 12-year run on Incredible Hulk, which was awesome. Mm. He did a great run on Aquaman, where he chopped his hand off, gave him the harpoon and all that, really developed Aquaman's mythology.
Yeah.
He is writing the Stephen King Dark Tower books for Marvel at the moment as well. He's done the few miniseries that they've had. So basically, I did a bit of research, and this Star Trek New Frontier, basically the book publishers wanted to launch a series of books that weren't tied into existing Star Trek TV characters.
Oh, okay.
Because there'd been Next Generation books, there'd been Deep Space Nine, Voyager, so they wanted to try something different. So most of these characters in New Frontier are new. They're not from the TV. It focuses on Captain Mackenzie Calhoun, and he's like this. He used to be a rebel leader on this planet, and then he kind of grew up to be this clandestine spy Federation officer. Captain Picard from Next Generation shows up. Spock shows up. Calhoun isn't the focus of the first book, but he is in the next books to come.
Okay.
And apparently, Peter David wrote quite a few Starfleet Academy young adult books as well, and he brought some of those characters over. All in all, since 1997, Peter David has written 17 Star Trek novels. That's like two a year.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I've noticed a similar trend with Star Wars novels. Like, they tend to be churned out at a quicker pace because the market demands it, I guess.
Yeah, and apparently they're so happy with him that Peter David's pretty much the only one who does these New Frontier books.
Hmm.
I've crossed over with other books, and they're all in canon and everything. Basically, it follows this whole new cast of characters on the USS Excalibur. They go to the troubled Thelonian Empire. That's like an empire in ruins and stuff. It's pretty good. It's obvious that it's a first book. There's a fair bit of setup and flashbacks.
Oh, yeah.
There's some action. There's a couple of almost sex scenes, which is pretty interesting.
Kirk always had almost sex scenes, didn't he?
What's that?
Captain Kirk used to have a lot of almost sex scenes. So I guess maybe they're continuing that tradition, maybe?
Yes. It's what a grand tradition it is, I'm sure. and actually, so that one of those sex scenes is Pon Farr, which is the Vulcan mating ritual, and they go into that in a fair bit of depth. So it's pretty interesting. It never comes across as funny. It's good. I mean, good on Peter David. I mean, geez, the man's pretty prolific. He's been writing comics and novels and who knows what else for years and years. So, if you do like Star Trek, Star Trek New Frontier, I think it's up to book 17 or 18 now.
Try reading a freaking book. And it doesn't have pictures, so this is the first for Chris.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha. No offense.
It's the first book I've read in about a year. I think the last book I read was last year, Last Days of Krypton, which is a Superman book.
Yeah, I'll lend you novels here and there, but I don't think they get read.
I'm looking at Stephen King, The Running Man. The picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger on the cover.
Yeah, the book is nothing like the film. It's actually pretty cool.
Okay, I'll give it a read.
More science fiction-y. It's pretty, it's not very heavy. Like, it's more man on the run kind of thing, except he's in the whole, he's running through the city rather than in a little game world with an opera singer. It's more like, it is televised, I think. Oh, it's been a while since I've read it. I think you should read Snow Crash. I'll lend you that. Neil Stevenson, very good stuff.
Oh, yes, you were telling me about that.
Yeah, the main character's name is Hero Protagonist.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Gutsy move. And he's like a ninja pizza delivery guy / hacker. Pretty entertaining. And he's chasing a dude who has an atomic bomb in a sidecar of his motorcycle, which is wired to explode if he gets killed, which is like his insurance for being a badass, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah, what are you going to do about it?
So it's quite tongue-in-cheek and funny.
Yeah, yeah, it's tongue-in-cheek, funny, and sort of, it was, I think it came out in 93, and it predicted a lot of the kind of internet culture that we have today, like in app, okay. in the sense of avatars and things. Like it was, and William Gibson had a similar thing. Neal Stephenson and William Gibson both managed to predict the future of the internet. So give those men prizes.
Indeed.
Yeah. Maybe they should write a Star Trek novel.
Sure, why not?
Yeah. So I think it's time we got into our anthropomorphic animals special. Talking funny animals is the
simple. Not always funny, just talking animals. So recommended reading list of talking animals.
Absolutely. After this little musical interlude. All right, this this week's special was probably a long time in the making because we were like, well, how are we going to talk about anthropomorphic animals? And my original thought was there's a lot of them, a hell of a lot.
Yes.
I guess the main the thing you can do with them is, as an artist, you can, because you are projecting human traits onto animals, you don't have that need to either make them look incredibly realistic, like as people. You can stretch realism a bit.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, so they're more abstract in terms of you can still think of them as people, as in the case of, say, mouse and so forth, but it gives you a bit more freedom as an artist, and you can get away with more as a writer as well. As an original thought, I guess humans have been doing this for forever. I mean, you look at cave paintings and stuff, and people, you know, made sculptures of animals. You've got Aesop's Fables, which are all talking animals and stuff.
True.
It's only logical that comics would take that on as well. And I guess one of the earliest modern examples is Mickey Mouse, which he was, of course, an animation creation of Walt Disney and another animator whose name I can't remember. That's how history works, my friend. and the artist in particular I want to talk about is Floyd Gottfredson, who worked on the Mickey Mouse comics for Disney through the 1930s. I was lucky enough to get a big, awesome hardcover book when I was quite young, and I have fond memories of it. But he started working on it in 1932 as like the Sunday strip, and it continued all the way to 38, and then they just sort of discontinued it and made it more of a gag thing. But Mickey Mouse at that stage was more of a, like a DuckTales kind of character. He had adventures, he solved crimes, he would use a gun, you know.
I think people are quite surprised, like the early... Yes. Mickey Mouse, like Disney don't show those anymore. There's one strip where he tried to kill himself in different ways.
Yeah, that was during Floyd Gottfredson's tenure cool. on the character. And he sort of devised that particular... A lot of the characters are already made, but he introduced this outside world of villainous characters like Eli Squinch, which is kind of like this tall, gangly Christopher... I can't remember his name. Doc Brown kind of looking guy, I guess.
Christopher
Lloyd. Yeah, I couldn't remember. Called Eli. Yeah, Eli Squinch, who's like a villainous miser. The Phantom Blot, which is like just a dude in a black Phantom of the Opera kind of thing. I don't know. No one seems to remember Horace Horsecollar and Clarabelle Cow.
But Clarabelle Cow, yes, I remember her. She had a bell on her neck.
Yes, that's right. And Horace Horsecollar was a horse who was one of the earlier Disney characters, but has since sort of fallen into...
Obscurity.
And he was Clarabelle's boyfriend, so a horse and a cow dating. Outrageous. I know, right? This was very progressive.
Didn't let kids watch that.
It was a very progressive comic book for its time. No. But the stories were like long continuing stories. Buried treasure, there'd be murders he'd be trying to solve, bank robbery. There's a good one where he tries to start a newspaper and... like his office keeps getting bombed by like a rival newspaper and his criminals who he's reporting on, you know. So it feels more like Tintin in many ways, and I think it's a precursor to that. There's guns, knives, murders, mystery, and there's a great series where Minnie leaves Mickey and he tries to kill himself in every strip for every week, and it's played quite funny. And the great thing is they're funny. Like the weekly format works as a gag at the end of every week. They're adventurous and quite exciting. And so if you can track these down, I definitely recommend you do. It's similar to Carl Barks's work on DuckTales.
Donald Duck.
Yeah, yep. Donald Duck and Scrooge. So, and probably lesser known because Mickey's kind of not as respected as a character anymore. He's become the corporate mascot.
Yeah, man, he's sold out.
He became more cute, That's the thing that happened to all of them. And that's the risk with anthropomorphic characters, is making them too cute. If you make them sort of act like people and make them really simple, like those early Mickey Mouse comics, it's quite easy to project yourself even onto like a horse. You know, you go, hey, I know what that guy's doing. I would do the same thing.
I swat flies away with my tail.
Yep. You just ruined it. No. What have you got?
Oh, boy. Well, I was going to mention that Boom Studios are currently publishing a lot of the Disney stuff, like Mickey Mouse, DuckTales, Darkwing Duck, and they've just launched Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers.
Are these new?
They're new. The new, brand new series, new stories.
They're continuing that adventure thing, aren't they?
Yeah, and they're monthly issues. So, if you have fond memories of all the Disney stuff and you want your kids to get into comics, Boom Studios, where they're Boom Kids, I think it's called. That's the place to go. Lions, Tigers and Bears was one I wanted to mention. It's got a couple of adults in it, but it is also an all-ages one. And it's, again, another Image. We've given an Image a lot of press these days, but that's okay. I expect our check in the mail. So this is from Image. There's been two volumes out. The first volume is what I have read nearly the other day. It's called Fear and Pride, Volume 1. It collects the first four issues, written by Mike Bullock and with art by Jack Lawrence. And the art is it's kind of Mike Waringo, who's sitting alone, no longer with us, but he did Flash and Robin in the mid-90s. It's kind of got that slightly Americanized manga style, quite, you know, big eyes and stuff and simple features, but the art is just great. It basically just focuses on this kid called Joey Price. He moves town. He hardly sees his mum. He's a bit upset. He doesn't have a dad, so his grandma gives him this collection of stuffed toys called the Knight of Pride. And basically they're for big cats, lions, tigers, etc. And they come alive and protect him from the beasties, who are like these big angry monsters who, you know, kind of like that Disney film Monsters Inc., you know, come from your closet or your wardrobe and scare you and stuff. So there's a bit of a tangle, and then Joey falls into the stuffed animal kingdom, really Narnia-like, and then he goes on to learn the power of imagination and courage, and he kind of uses his imagination for good. And yeah, it's actually pretty good. It is obviously an all-ages book, but I enjoyed it. And this is kind of at the – this is published, I think, 2005, the original first four-issue miniseries, so when the all-ages kind of swing was just starting. For a long time there wasn't any all-ages comics in the industry. Now we've seen a bit of a resurgence of that. So, yeah, Lions, Tigers, and Bears, there's two volumes out now. The third volume is going to be about in the next couple of months from Hermes Press. There's been talk of a film for a while. But, yeah, again, if you want to get your kids into something, the first volume is out now. It's got a good gallery in there and inspiration for the story. And, yeah, I'm just looking at the pages now. It is very good art.
I think I had a quick squiz at it. And, the art's quite pretty. I do notice that you read a lot of all-ages books. Is that for the fan?
I used to, when I was a richer man, I used to give all ages comics to kids at hospitals. So I used to look in previews and then see what was interesting and then just buy them. And then just, so I did that for a couple of years, but I'm far too self-centered to do that. Now I just don't have the money to do it anymore.
You realize it was a waste of time.
And now I've got, you know, nieces and nephews that are reading now, so, and they're really into their superheroes and stuff as well. So when it's I see something like this, I like to pick it up.
Cool.
So that's, another all-ages action-adventure kind of one.
What was it called again? Forgot.
Lions, Tigers and Bears.
Look into it, folks.
LTB.
What?
LTB. It's often abbreviated as.
What is? Lions. Oh, got you. Right, yeah. Okay, the thing we're talking about. Yeah, that's what you're talking about. Got you.
What about Ninja Turtles?
What about Ninja Turtles? Yeah, okay. Eastman and Laird in the what was it, 88-ish?
Oh, I wonder 86. How much he's, because wasn't he selling all his Ninja Turtles goodies? Maybe we mentioned that a couple of months ago.
Yeah, he had a big auction of everything he'd ever accumulated of all his, I guess.
Ninja Turtle toothpaste and hubcaps and everything. He sold them all. I wonder how much it went for.
You know, that's something we should have researched before bringing it up.
Should stop doing this, shouldn't I? Anyway,
we should
carry
pause
on.
And then pretend that we knew it off the top of our head. I can't be bothered. Anyway, yeah, Kevin Eastman and
Peter Laird,
is it? Yeah. Okay. Yes. Good. Yeah, they invented the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Leonardo, Raphael, Donatello, and Michelangelo, based off the Renaissance painters for some reason. And they are ninja fighting crime fighters, ninjas. Okay, I guess we should explain. It was originally a comic book, which was a bit over the top, a bit sort of tongue-in-cheek in its Frank Millerisms. It came out sort of after Ronan and Frank Miller's run on Daredevil. So the characters were quite like gruesome, bloody. They liked killing people more than kind of
Saturday morning cartoon is allowed.
Yes, and all their bandanas were red, which everyone likes to point out.
Yes, and they didn't have their alphabet on their belt buckles.
No, which is useful for each other for some reason. Yeah, like you think they would know their own names. Anyway, it's like why would you need a name tag to wear at home? Don't get the point. Yeah. They would have been screwed if there were two of them starting with D, or you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. D1 and D2. Yeah. Unless it's like the bananas and pajamas.
In their case, they didn't have really anything to do with turtles. They were kind of played as the opposite. They were trying to think which animal is furthest away from sneaky, fast, stealthy creatures. Turtles, you know. Or more tortoises would be slower, wouldn't they? Turtles can swim fast, but they lived in a sewer with their pet rat master and so forth. But one of my favorite runs on the comic, and I think you've read this one as well, Michael Zulli, who's worked on Sandman, among many other things, very kind of like a soft pencil style to his art.
Yep.
Kind of Bill Sienkiewicz sort of flavor, if you like. And his run on the first sort of run on Ninja Turtles was he did like three or four issues, and they were amazing. So get those if you can. Ninja Turtles otherwise, it's well worth picking up the original comics. Have you rewatched the films recently, I should say?
I haven't. I did like the recent CGI one that they did, and I think there's talk of doing another one, but I haven't watched the live-action films, one of which is starring Vanilla Ice, for some time.
Yep. Well, I've rewatched them all fairly recently. I still like the first, but I recognise that it's not a good film, really, by any stretch. But at least you can sense they were trying. And then the third one, they definitely weren't trying.
They went back in time, didn't they?
Yeah, it was pretty dumb. I liked.
And then there was the new TV series with the female Venus de Milo.
Yeah, that's right. That was around the same time as the Power Rangers, so they had a crossover at one stage. Yes, awesome. Yeah, pretty dumb. Similar sort of thing. Yeah, the female turtle. What were they thinking? But what was I going to say? Yeah, the recent movie. You're right. The one through Imagi, was it? The ones who did Astro Boy, so that's two bombs, because neither of those films did well. And as you mentioned, they are making a new one, but it's going to be live action.
Awesome.
Again. So they'll probably do some blend of maybe some facial animations or something on puppetry men.
See, I like the original costumes they had in the first live action.
I think they're really well done. That was Jim Henson Studio worked on those.
Ah, of course. Yes. Jimmy does good work.
You can tell the quality straight away.
Yeah,
you know, or if you see the name Stan Winston or Jim Henson Studio, you know you're going to get some really awesome puppets out of it.
Yeah,
yeah. Like when I watched The Thing recently, Stan Winston, I realized was did some of the effects in it and was kind of an advisor as well. I'm like, see, you can just pick the good stuff, can't you? But that's not about talking animals. What am I doing? What else you got?
I was going to mention Usagi Yojimbo. That just came off the top of my head by Stan Sakai, Dark Horse. But I don't know if that's...
That was a spin-off of Ninja Turtles, wasn't it?
I think he appeared originally outside of Ninja Turtles. The comic's been going for a while. He's a samurai rabbit, I believe.
Yeah.
And then I think he guest starred in the Ninja Turtles for a few episodes and even had his own action figure for a while. But, similar kind of... and it's still going around. The series has been going for ages.
It's interesting in that period where artists would indie artists who did those kind of adventure stories would let each other use each other's characters. So Cerebus and Usagi Yojimbo and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles kind of cross over into each other's books, which was it'd be quite unheard of now for a lot of indie creators to do that.
Because Eastman Laird, they kicked off the independent self-publishing wave that was kind of happening in that period, and then when Ninja Turtles kind of became a huge Saturday morning yeah, I guess it inspired everybody else to come up with the same thing. I remember Samurai Pizza Cats and all that kind of stuff. Yojimba, published in 1987 and it's still going today.
I've never actually read it myself. But,
me neither, but I'm just familiar that when we were talking about Ninja Turtles, I just recalled. I don't know if many more in the kind of action adventure category.
It does segue into Cerebus, so I'll just mention it briefly. Dave Sims' creation, the Aardvark, is a satire on swords and sorcery comics initially, and like Conan, Krull. Was it Krull or Krull? I can't remember. Krull the Conqueror.
Krull, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's that movie Krull where the Cyclops gets crushed in the wall. I had nightmares of that as a kid. And then when you lent me the film not so long ago, and then I saw that scene, and it was like
freaked out.
I felt like a kid for that brief moment again. Which was
Krull. It is Krull.
Yeah,
starring Liam Neeson.
Really?
And Robbie Coltrane.
What? No.
Yeah, Liam Neeson was one of his first films.
Who was he?
And Robbie Coltrane. Liam, he was one of the the bandits. Robbie Coltrane's in it as one of those as well. He plays what's his face in the Harry Potter movies? The big fat guy with the beard.
Dumbledore.
Ron. Hagrid. Hagrid.
No.
Hagrid.
What? Hermione.
Harvey.
Hermione. They all have Hagrid. Beards now. Doesn't Daniel Radcliffe have a beard? I saw a picture of the recent film, the new one that's coming out, and the kid who plays Neville is now looks so 30 or 40 years old.
Yeah,
it's not a good look when they're meant to look 17. I'll get revenge on you. Too deep. He should be high pitched.
Young Christian Bale. Yes.
Yeah, but sorry, yeah, Cerebus, that's what I was talking about. I'd recommend people try and check out Cerebus, maybe start around volume 5. There's about 15 or 16 phone book-sized tome volumes, black and white comic that Dave Sim did 500 issues of on his own with Gerard, a Canadian illustrator who joined him years later just to help him draw the backgrounds because it was very time intensive. And he uses his little Aardvark character as a stand-in for himself eventually to ruminate on all his personal issues with... I mean, Dave Sim now is kind of a bit unpopular as a human being for his opinions on feminism and women and... their value in society, and he states some of that openly himself, but he also speaks through the character, which he's acknowledged that's the case. But he does ruminate on some pretty heavy philosophical concepts, which is quite rare for a comic starring a talking aardvark who is a bit of a bad egg. Have you ever read any?
I haven't. It's huge, isn't it? And he only finished it, a year or two ago.
Yeah, not so long ago, 4 or 5 years. But, 2005-ish, that sounds right. Yeah.
And there's, huge phone book-sized tomes.
Yeah, they're quite tricky to track down now. It's not continuously in print, so you'd be lucky to find one now. But, it's if you're into kind of philosophically heavy comics, quite verbose, surprisingly verbose, starring a unlikable protagonist who at one point drops a baby off a rooftop while giving a speech. He sort of declares himself ruler, king, and pope of the entire continent at one stage in the comic. And with ultimate power comes ultimate corruption and demanding that everyone donate gold to him.
Wow.
Yeah. So, interesting comic. You would hate it because it does bash religion. Religion, less so God. So maybe you wouldn't mind it then.
Yeah.
But, I just wanted to mention that one. What else you got?
Cool. I do want to mention, I guess a similar vein, Elephant Men from Comic Craft and Image. And I must point out this is something I haven't read, but I'm vaguely familiar with, and I just wanted to point it out as a well-respected anthro tale.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got the first two hardcover volumes. It's been going for, I think, 3 or 4 years now. And it's awesome. Comic Craft is my studio set up by Richard Starkings, who's one of the best letterers in the industry.
Yeah.
And he's the creator and writer of this story, Elephant Men, which spun out from Hip Flask. which I think you mentioned a while ago, is like a noir hippo type character. So Elephant Man is in that same kind of world. Mm. So yeah, he writes it, and basically it's like a site, it's set a couple of hundred years in the future, and it stars genetically engineered soldiers who are made hybrids from different African animals. So there's like Ebenezer Hyde, he's an elephant, there's Tusk, who's a warthog, there's Obadiah Horn, who's a rhino, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And kind of look, just flicking through it this afternoon, it kind of looks like a like Blade Runner, but with animals instead of androids or replicants. Right.
Okay.
Artist Moritat does the art for the most of this series, but there's a few guest artists in every now and then, so the art kind of flicks between a more cartoony style and a more European, I guess, approach.
Mm.
Chris Bacallo does a couple issues. He's done a lot of X-Men work. I think the whole thing is very European. I think if you like Black Sad, which we'll talk about later,
okay,
you would like this just because some pages seem quite sparse. There's not a lot of talking, not even a lot of fighting necessarily. But
sounds good.
Yeah, visually quite an issue, and a very well designed book. Like just the design elements are pretty, you know, just the credits pages and the logos and all that.
It seems very well presented.
It is. That's Elephant Men from Comic Craft and Image, and that's been around for a while. So if you like something a bit more serious.
Mm-hmm. On the same topic of a hippo who is a detective, I don't know if we've mentioned it, but there is a whole debacle with the Hairbutt the Hippo character.
I don't think he's still around, though. But
he's not still around. He was an Australian comic book character in the early 90s, published in comic form and also as part of Mad Magazine. So it was fairly well distributed. I think just within Australia, though. I don't think the American editions published it. And after that comic died in around 94, Elephant Men started up in, what, early 2000s, something like that?
Yep.
The original, it published like for a few years, and then the original creator of Hairbutt kind of said, well, what's going on? Did you read my comic? Are you ripping me off? I don't understand. It was just interesting that it was also a hippo, also a detective, and they were both tongue-in-cheek satire, but it became pretty clear that it was a coincidence, but that didn't stop them from writing rude letters to each other, which are available freely online. So that's how everyone should resolve their conflict, through open letters to the internet that will be online forever.
It does seem very unpopular in comic circles, unfortunately.
As
you'd even surprise, actual comic creators will jump online and respond to something that a fan has said, or whatever. It's like, oh, geez, just.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if I was a writer, I don't think I'd read anything because you'd be too tempted to go, well, you're an idiot, you're a doo-doo head. And then, yeah, like I said, it's up there forever. Yeah. And
a lot of writers say that, like, they don't read reviews, they don't. Or they might read print reviews because it's, you know, it's, you know, professional, but they never go on forums or online to see what people are saying about their work because they go nuts. Except on the Image forums, you can usually find a few. Brian Wood lurks around the comic book resources forums, if anyone's interested, as does Jason Aaron, as we all know.
Gail Simone is quite, I think Brian Michael Bendis as well.
They're Ron Mars too, open. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can directly confront these people, although they can ignore you or contact the forum admins to ban you. So be careful.
Well, I don't think I'd purposely go out of my way to say something bad about someone online. Like if I respected a writer's or artist's work, I'd say so. But
nothing slanderous is what you're saying.
DC Comics are bringing back letters pages.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think it's dccomics.letters.com or something. You can basically just fill out a form and they're going to put letters, which they got rid of in 2002 as this old internet fad.
To fit more ads in.
took over. So, so they're bringing back letters pages. So I don't know how they're going to make them timely because usually books are printed or, you know, a couple of months in advance or whatever. So
that's a fair question.
Apparently they've got a way around it, so I guess they'll just hold off and press until the last minute and then
With the ad pages you get a bit, they have more time leniency, that the print setting's not as complicated for black text on white, you know, so
they can
add that at a later stage, so there's that. But that's not about animals, is it? Yeah.
Howard the Duck,
and that's a good good companion piece to Cerebus. I'm not as familiar with Howard the Duck, but I've honestly never read any. Quite rare to track down.
Oh, George Lucas made the movie. I think it was his only flop, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a huge flop, and they try not to mention it. I think if you were ever doing like an introduction, we should have done it for our Star Wars thing. George Lucas, creator of Howard the Duck.
Howard the Duck.
Yeah. No one ever talks about American Graffiti. That movie's okay.
Oh, I've never seen it.
It's all right. It's a bit like Happy Days if it was serious and it stuck to its kind of thematic, like, period. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Happy Days plays more fast and loose, and it stars a lot of the same actors. I think Ron Howard plays kind of a similar character, and then Happy Days was a bit of a spin-off, I think, of that film. Okay. Yeah. Good to know.
Howard the Duck, created by Steve Gerber and Val Mayer. Yeah, kind of like you said, like a Marvel equivalent of Cerebus, like a duck that an angry Donald Duck, I guess, has a cigar, walks around and doesn't like people. Hasn't been around for years and years, but he did have his own series for quite a while.
Do you remember when they switched him with another animal?
Oh, it became a monkey or a...
He became something else. Was it a rabbit or a frog?
A rat, yeah, that was it.
A rat, was it? Okay. Yes. Yeah, because they've secured the rights to the writing but not the character design. So they got around it by having him transform. Because his thing was he did travel between dimensions, I think. He was from a dimension where everyone's ducks, kind of like a DuckTales world, and then he ends up in our world. And he's similar to a lot of Anthro characters who are animals but they're surrounded by people, which is what Elephant Man is, it's what Cerebus is, and Mickey Mouse is a kind of a similar thing when he's surrounded by people. You either get worlds which are completely populated by animals, or you get ones which is an animal in a human world, and I like the ones where no one ever notices or mentions that they're an animal.
Yeah, it's kind of like Brian, the dog in Family Guy.
Yeah, he's just a talking dog.
Assumes, yeah.
Hey, there's that talking dog.
And Howard the Duck knows martial arts. The martial art known as Quack Fu.
Yeah. Is there a lot of duck puns?
I don't know. I just remember that.
Oh wow. Okay. He's not at all like I guess Gizmo Duck or Darkwing Duck or any of those guys, is he?
No, he's not one for the kids, really.
Who was the DuckTales character who was like RoboCop?
Was the RoboCop?
Yeah, he was like a. He had instead of legs, he had like one wheel.
That's freaky.
It was his own cartoon he'd guest on DuckTales as well. And Darkwing Duck was, I think, another spin-off of DuckTales as well. But he's the one. It might be Gizmo Duck. It's not important, but it's going to bug me all night now.
Well, you can Google it while I talk about the next one.
Do.
Elmer, E-L-M-E-R, like Elmer Fudd. It's a comic that came out a couple of years ago in individual comics as 4-issue miniseries in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now been published as a collection by SLG, Slave Labor Graphics. It's by a writer artist, Jerry Alanguilan. He's quite, even though I can't say his name, he's quite well known.
Yeah.
I'm not as good as you, but, you know.
It's not that funny. I shouldn't laugh.
So fragile. You know, I'm like an eggshell. That's how fragile I am. And you have crushed me and hurt my yolk. He's quite well known. He spent like the last 20 years doing inking. So he's done a lot of inking stuff for Marvel and DC. And basically it says in the back here that it's like a 2-page little essay, I guess, from him saying where the story came from. It's a black and white book and it focuses on a story where chickens become sentient.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it focuses on a family of chickens from the 1970s to today. There's no real explanation how these chickens around the world kind of woke up one day and had the power of speech, but they slowly talk like cavemen and then they get more and more intelligent. And then, yeah, as I said, it happens to all the chickens. So it obviously shifts the balance, not the balance of power, but humans are realize, oh boy, you know, we've been decapitating chickens for years and eating all their gizzards. Now what? So kind of the chickens rise up, and it's not a black comedy. Like when you first hear it, think this is ridiculous, but it's actually it's taken extremely seriously, and you can almost see some of the Civil War era movement of civil rights movement in our own human history kind of mirrored here in this book.
Right.
So it's actually pretty interesting. The black and white art is very, very intricate. Like all the chickens look differently, surprisingly. And it basically just focuses on this one family of chickens in the Gallo family, G-A-L-L-O. Their dad has just passed away, and he passed his diary chronicling the rise of the chicken race to his son, and he basically tasks his son, who wants to be a writer, to finish the book. So we see the present day, and then we flash back to excerpts of the diary. We learn more about, you know, how humans got to hate chickens, and they go and lynch mobs and kill chickens, and some of the chickens fight back, you know, like cockfighting. So they have like those little spiky things on their legs and gouge humans' eyes out and stuff. So it's surprisingly bloody.
Right.
Even though it's got talking chickens in it, it's not one for the kids. But yeah, I really found it to quite interesting. And I mean, there are some funny bits in there, like the main character, who's the son who's carrying on his dad's work, trying to finish the diary. His name's Jake. And then his brother is an actor who the rest of the family think may be gay. And then his sister, who's also a chicken, is engaged to a human doctor to be married. And so they've got like normal human kind of familial dramas and relationships, but they're seen through the eyes and beaks of chickens.
Okay.
It's very, in the design wise, it's quite grid like and not as trippy as, I guess, Infinite Vacation or something like that would be. But yeah, it's quite a beautiful looking book, very delicate, very some really great fine line work, and quite thought provoking in a lot of ways. Like, you can see that it's quite an allegory for how we treat other races and cultures.
That's what I was going to ask, yeah.
And it is a bit of a microcosm, even though you get the picture that this is happening all over the world. So, yeah, I actually had KFC for dinner tonight, and I actually felt quite guilty. So that's a good book. It's published by Slave Labor Graphics, and it's called Elma. And I guess it's a good example of this, as you said, anthropomorphic can be used as a mask to tell any number of tales, whether it be comedy or all ages or straight out action adventure or something a lot deeper and meaningful like this, or Mouse.
Yeah, this clearly reminds me of that Cows with Guns song, especially that last line where cows become sentient and they rise up against people, and at the end they look like they're beaten, but then the chickens and choppers arrive at the last second. And that's exactly what all I could think of was the tune to that song while you were telling that. But yeah, you do see similar things in something like in We Three, which is also kind of animals becoming sentient to a human level and understanding their mistreatment. And it's meant to make you redress how we treat animals as well. I mean, I don't want to get too much into we can get into We Three as well. That's Grant Morrison's tale. I believe that was on your list.
Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely. Yeah, I guess that's more of the superhero flip side of Elma. That came out, I think, in the early 2000s, basically just a one-shot. And it's been hailed one of Grant Morrison's greatest Scottish writer, Grant Morrison, one of his best work. Yeah, basically tells the tale of a dog, a cat and a rabbit. And they go on the run, and they basically, they're military experiments. Mm-hmm. So do they actually talk? I don't know.
Yeah, they can talk to each other. They're given voices, and yeah, as you said, they're weaponized, and it's
pretty violent as well.
Crazy ideas thrown around. I'd actually agree it's one of Grant Morrison's better works, in that it has the most concise presentation of his ideas, but it balances actual good characterization, and you actually really care about the characters, which is which is something he's not always the best at. But he really excels at it here, and it's not hard when they're animals. And that is like, as you were saying, it's a good tool that writers use when you were talking about race relations, because people are more sympathetic towards animals sometimes than people.
True.
So just dressing it in the idea of you're mistreating animals, people just redress how they think about things.
I remember when A Fish Called Wanda came out, the John Cleese film,
right?
Jamie Lee Curtis in the '80s, and there was a scene where the that old lady, she's like walking her dog, and one of the dogs dies. A piano drops on her.
Yes,
and they got all these complaints about the dog dying, but nobody cared about the human characters kept getting
multiple people
severely.
Getting shot and stuttering guy getting tortured. Doggy. Yeah, and they I was listening to a bit of the commentary on that film. And in that scene, their original cut had a bit of blood running out, And that tested so poorly on test theaters that they had to turn it into little cartoon legs, like going when it gets crushed, like Wizard of Oz-esque, you know, like the legs under the house, just so it would get past, and people were still like, "What have you done?" So people, are very sensitive about animals, and as you mentioned, even just anthropomorphizing people to make them more like animals in the case of Mouse, which I guess is the opposite sense of something like We Three, to tell a story about, well, the Nazi concentration camps, an autobiographical tale, where the animal thing is kind of just a tool to simplify the art and to help you relate to the characters more. It removes that barrier of them being drawn people, and you can focus more on the characterization almost. And of course, there's the whole cats and mouse thing that's happening. And it's interesting. Spiegelman breaks down the metaphor halfway through. Like in the second volume, they turn into people with animal masks, and he draws himself. Like, and you can clearly see he's there, but he's wearing like a mask over his face, and he's like, "Oh God, have I spoiled the metaphor?" And so I guess artists are clued into using it the right way. Did you have any particular thoughts on Mouse or?
No, but I guess it was perhaps one of the earlier examples of using anthropomorphic tales to tell a serious, very, very serious subject matter. The only other one I did mention very briefly is Black Sad.
Of course.
We did mention it during our detective special, so I don't want to go into it too much.
No.
But it's basically Black Sad is a series of, well, they've done four albums, so four, we'd call them original graphic novels here in the West, but I think in Europe they call them albums, something that Grand Denise or whatever it is, the French word.
Yes.
So it's by Spanish authors Juan Diaz Canales, he's the writer, and Juanjo Guarnido is the artist. Oh man, I'm really struggling. They're Spanish, but it sells really well in France. Dark Horse last year published a hardcover collection of the first three original graphic novels. The fourth one was released in September last year and sold hundreds of thousands of copies. Basically, it's a very standard Hitchcockian noir tale, so a lot of detectives, damsels in distress, and you know, corrupt cops and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of set in a post-World War II period, you know, where you know men wear suits and ties everywhere, that kind of thing.
Sure.
The stories aren't mind-blowingly original, and basically it's just noir tales, but with you know dogs and cats and rhinos and bears and stuff.
Beautifully illustrated, I should say. Yeah,
wonderfully illustrated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it takes them so long. I think the first one was published in 2000. They've only done four since then. So because it is quite time consuming. A wonderfully, for a European sensibility again, wonderfully coloured, and just an awesome book. If you can't get a hold of the English translation, as published by Dark Horse, which is basically a big black cover with a black. Black Sad is the name of the main detective. He's a cat. He's smoking on the cover. Big, nice, juicy close-up. Grab yourself a copy of that if you can. So, serious, quite adult. I mean, it's like, you know, cat nudity and that kind of stuff. A bit of violence. Wonderfully.
Cat nudity. Straight. I guess just to bring things back lighter, I did want to briefly mention Sam and Max because they've always been some of my favourites. Steve Purcell's comic book from 1987, which was then adapted into the LucasArts video game, the adventure game that some of you may remember. Sam and Max Hit the Road, like the point-and-click ones. And then recently, again, Telltale have come out with more adventure games featuring the characters. It stars a detective dog who wears the hat, the suit, the tie, and he's more of like – he's like a gruff kind of I don't know who reminds me, a bit of Rodney Dangerfield almost thrown in. Like, he's a little bit more silly, I guess.
No respect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, he doesn't sound or look anything like him, but I get that sort of vibe of age group and stuff. And his partner's this homicidal sociopath, white bunny, who wears no clothes. And just, they go around, they're freelance police, and they go around solving crimes usually by sort of silly means. There's cockroaches and rats usually help them, and they tend to murder people by accident because they just have no regard for the safety of others. Very wisecracky, witty characters. And there was a collection that recently came out, I think in 2007-ish. I think I lent to you, and that was Sam Max Surfing the Highway. So that's a collection of all those comics there. Well worth picking up. And I guess, animals make for good laughs, don't they? Good they laughs. Do. And I mean, Far Side, I love their use of animals for was it Gary Larson? Is that it?
Yep.
Yeah. His use of cows in particular for the kind of allegorical laughs. Yes. Much funnier than something like Garfield, which I also had on my list, but I don't even want to talk about Garfield. Is that still being... No, the author died, didn't he?
Really?
Okay, maybe I'm completely off here. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was thinking Charles Schultz died a couple of years ago.
Ah, for Peanuts, yeah. They're making a new Peanuts film, actually. Happiness is a Warm Blanket, Charlie Brown.
Animated or live-action starring
animated. Animated in the same style from the 60s and 70s.
Wow.
Okay. Cartoons, like the Christmas one they did and stuff.
Mm. Those weren't good quality cartoons, but I guess they have their retro charm.
Yeah, they're quite popular, apparently. Yeah,
people have very fond memories. I still think the comics are much better than the cartoons, but that's just me. Good use of jazz music in those. Do you remember?
No, but I trust you when it comes to music.
And I guess just because I don't know if you had any more to go on, but I guess...
Not really.
Yeah, just to lead out, because we haven't done a website of the week in forever.
Okay, yes.
This does tie in directly to the topic.
Sure.
This has recently come up. There's a webcomic called Lackadaisy, I should say, and it's like an animal kind of 1940s gangster thing. But he recently, and because we were talking about their use of being able to express emotions and stuff, like they're easier to draw, he's just put out a print, which is his advice for drawing expressions. It's very I'd say like the art quality and approach is similar to Black Sad. I think you might like it, maybe a bit more cartoony. It looks similar to it, and it's actually a really good little useful resource for artists, because he gives some really good advice for drawing expressions and what to avoid and what not to do. And he in particular points out the one smarm brow look, which everyone uses and is the most overused expression in animation. You know DreamWorks, all their posters have, everyone said they all pull that same face, which is like the bit of the half smile with one eyebrow raised.
Yeah.
Like Shrek, all those characters do that face. But it's quite amusing. And he really rips into people who use kind of emoticon manga faces, like, you know, the kawaii faces.
Yeah.
It's good.
What's the website?
Lackadaisy.com.
Spell it.
lackadaisy.foxprints.com, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool little webcomic, and it relates to the topic for once. So that's the first website of the week for like 10 weeks.
Yeah, we kind of ran out for a while there.
Bring it back. Old school.
Nice one.
Yeah.
Well, that about puts a bow on that, I think.
Yeah. What are we going to be bringing the people next week?
Don't know, but in the near future, we are going to do a special look at 1986.
Ooh. Okay.
It's the as recommended by a couple of fans of the show. It's the 25th anniversary of the year, 1986, and we thought there was actually quite a interesting time in pop culture, not only films but also obviously comics with Mouse, Watchmen, Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns,
and a few surprises we'll save for that week. I'm sure we don't want to give it away too early, do we? But it was a big year for comics, and bearing in mind that next week is our 25th episode, do you reckon we can do it? I reckon we should time it for 25th episode is the 25th anniversary for 86. Let's do it, man.
We could do that, yes.
Don't need that much preparation. Let's do it. Okay, next week, 1986 special.
Okay.
The year of my birth, my friend.
Really?
Yes.
I was 10.
It's so weird. People must like hear that and go, oh, what the hell do you two hang out for? Yeah.
Some old guy on the radio.
Talking about comics. No, not you being gross, just like the age difference, and we're here yakking about comics. But hey, man, comics have no age barrier.
They bring the world together.
Yes, it's not a divisive force of evil. It's a force of good.
That's right.
Yeah. You are my Donald Duck to my Scrooge McDuck.
Oh, thank you. And you are my Minnie to my Mickey. No, that's not right.
Stop that. No, you're my Clarabelle Cow to my Horace Corsicle.
Yes, I've got artists.
Oh, what have we done? Okay, that's
If you want to listen to all our previous episodes, go to extrasequential.com. We're also on iTunes, Mixcloud. My blog is comicbookjesus.com. gmail.com.
Yeah, music.
And you can email the show. Hang on there. I'm getting there.
Sorry, I forgot. Easy. Forgot.
I have 10 years on you.
You're wasting time.
And if you want to email the show, it's Chris with a K, K-R-I-S, at extrasequential.com. If you want to recommend any other anthropomorphic comics or future themes for the show.
We love your theme ideas.
Themes. Go.
Go now?
Go now. It's your turn. No, your time to speak.
Now?
Yes, now.
Now?
Jerry, we're getting a delay.
Okay. PurgeAndAudit.com is my music for the show, and that wraps us up. That's it. Bye.
We're done.
I've been Malad, and that other guy was Chris. And, tell us what you think.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. See you, mate.
Bye-bye.